Today on Against the Grain. In 1936, Nazi Germany hosted the Summer Olympic Games in Berlin amidst international calls for a boycott. It was an enormously consequential event in the politics of the times, granting Hitler an international spotlight to promote the Third Reich. Much less known, as writer Michael Waters argues, is how Nazi eugenics and paranoia about transgender athletes gave rise to the gender surveillance that characterizes contemporary sports to this day. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Olympic Games have, since their inception in the late 19th century, been as much about politics as sports. Nowhere has this been more apparent than during the 1936 Berlin Summer Olympics, hosted by Fascist Germany. The Games took place at the time when the international media was fixated on several European athletes who had been assigned female at birth, but transitioned to living as men. In the other Olympians, Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports, writer Michael Waters has discovered the stories of these almost forgotten transgender athletes, and he illustrates how the Nazis' reactionary notions of gender ultimately gave rise to how sports officials view and regulate athletes' gender today. Michael, to start off, can you give us an overview of the politics of the Olympics in its early years, including who organized it?
The modern Olympics that we know today trace back to the 1890s, when they were founded by this French aristocrat named Pierre de Coubertin. And while I think today we tend to think of the Olympics as this mostly well-oiled machine, the early Olympics were not really that at all. They were governed largely by this body of officials who were all men, many of whom were aristocrats descended from like landed gentry across Europe. And these were men who sort of got this place in the Olympics and governing the Olympics because of wealth and status, and sometimes less so because of a knowledge about sports management. And so for spectators of the early Olympics, especially in the early 1900s, that meant that a lot of these events were kind of chaotic. You know, there were all sorts of rumors in the early 1900s about, like, during the marathon, you know, a certain runner would disappear for long stretches of time, but then would suddenly appear at the front. And there were all sorts of like whispers that someone had cheated and just like literally taken a car to get to the front of the race. You had athletes who were run off course by like whole packs of dogs. And you had other athletes who just sort of like quit the race and then walked back to the center of the stage and were actually hailed as the victor. They were pretty chaotic events in those early years. And I think that was in large part because of, it took the Olympics a while to figure out how governance worked. And so eventually you had other figures coming in, especially when you get into the 1910s and you have the rise of these like sports federations that operated under the International Olympic Committee. So these federations would govern like track and field sports, or like skiing, for instance, kind of their own specific niches. And they began setting rules around, you know, like how to count a world record, who could play in these sports, you know, like what would be out of bounds, what would not be out of bounds. And so it's in the 1910s where you kind of start to see some of this more modern bureaucracy that we know at the Olympics today begin to form.
Obviously, the Olympics is a competition between nations and their national athletes. Was a sense of nationalism kind of baked in at the very beginning in terms of how different countries saw the importance of the Olympics and what kind of self-representation it would put forth?
I think the Olympics sort of have always embodied this interesting contradiction. And you see that really even through the lens of Pierre de Coubertin, this modern founder of the Olympics. So on one hand, Coubertin, like one of the reasons that he first was moved to start this international sports competition was because of actually a military defeat by men serving in the army of his native France. And he saw this and he began to worry about specifically like the men in France losing the sense of like masculinity or virility. And he thought sports could be a way to like bring that back and to train soldiers in some respect. So there was kind of like this like nationalist, militarist impulse in Coubertin on one hand, and then on the other, he talked about the Olympics as actually being kind of this tool of diplomacy. You know, if you could get, he thought, if you could get all these countries to participate in sports together, that would actually make it easier for countries to come together. Maybe that would relieve some tensions between nations. And so, you know, I think when we look at the Olympics throughout history, including today, you see kind of a contradiction there where it's supposed to be about bridging divides, but also it's a very nationalist thing where, you know, one country gets to say we won the most gold medals at the end of the day. And also the Olympics is a political body that decides who's even allowed to be a country. I think you see that right from the start. And you see really early on in the history of the Olympics too, this idea that the Olympics could be a tool for kind of like advertising a country, and they could be a tool for broadcasting power in these different ways. And I think you see this a little bit in a lot of the early Olympics, but I think you really start to see this going into the 1920s and 1930s. A really important example of this, I think, is in 1932, when the city of Los Angeles hosts the Olympics for the first time. They spend a ton of money trying to kind of like put LA on the map. And this is 1932. This is during the height of the Great Depression. And even so, you know, the state of California is still pumping lots of money towards creating all this infrastructure for the Olympics, even as, you know, plenty of Californians who are out of work are protesting it. And so, like, once the Olympics does happen, there are all kinds of parties where Hollywood stars gather. They go out to nightclubs together. And you actually see, you can kind of trace the origins of palm trees in LA to the Olympics. They were planted en masse kind of to promote this sense of LA as an oasis. And so you see this idea of like, by having the Olympics, we can make ourselves more prestigious and put ourselves on the world map. You start to see that really in the 20s and 30s. And then I think that becomes crystallized in the Olympics that I talk most about in my book, which is the Berlin Olympics in 1936, where you have this Nazi regime that is trying to legitimate itself and its fascist ideas to the world. And it really does so through the lens of the Olympics itself, kind of seeing these earlier examples and then building upon that. And so I think that's like the Olympics that I think really becomes a turning point for all of these questions about nationhood, and the Olympics themselves.
And it's interesting because precisely that template that you were describing in Los Angeles and then Berlin is one that has persisted to this day, with cities doing their utmost to, and countries to court the Olympic Committee to be chosen, to be designated as the site of the next Olympics. And then the controversial things that go on within cities, Barcelona or other cities where slums are cleared, huge amounts of money are poured into cities, and cities are transformed at enormous cost and not necessarily benefit to the local inhabitants, but it is all about projecting oneself into the world. Which leads me to the question of how did Nazi Germany end up as the host of the infamous 1936 Summer Olympics, one of the most momentous Olympics in history?
To tell that story of how Nazi Germany came to host the 1936 Olympics, you maybe have to go all the way back to 1916. And essentially, Germany was supposed to host this Olympics in 1916. And if you've not heard of the 1916 Olympics, that's because it did not happen. 1916 was during World War I, and so the Olympics were understandably canceled. And so Germany, is this kind of in the 1910s when it's supposed to host its first Olympics, it's this kind of budding sports power. You see a lot of sports officials kind of coming to power in Germany, trying to create these different kind of like sports sciences and make Germans to be a more dynamic set of athletes. Other countries were just like far better at the Olympics prior to the 1910s. And so, in 19, like G the Germans looked at the 1916 Olympics as this chance to enter the world stage. That didn't happen. And then after World War I, Germany was not invited back to the next two Olympics that happened just because of their tactics during the war itself. And so you kind of start to see, as soon as Germany is back in the fold in the 1920s, you start to see them pushing and pushing to sort of recapture what this canceled Olympics was supposed to do for the country and for its space in the sporting world. And there are a number of figures who are pushing for this. One of them is named Theodore Luwald. I don't have to go too much into detail, but essentially what happens is that in the late 20s and early 30s, these German sports officials who serve on the International Olympic Committee are successfully able to get the IOC to approve its bid. They had a really, it was a really like vaguely worked out plan. They actually didn't really have the money to fund this remodeling of their old stadium that was supposed to host the 1916 Olympics, but they kind of pretended to. But this was all before the Nazis had fully come to power in Germany. And so the IOC approved Germany to host the Berlin Olympics in 1936 prior to the Nazi takeover. What you see happen once the Nazis do rise to power is you see this boycott movement that starts to spring up in many different countries across the world. But in particular, it's strongest in the United States. And you see all sorts of activists, and especially a lot of anti-fascist Jewish activists pointing out that to give the Olympics to Nazi Germany would be to almost validate their ideology. And there are tons of people pushing back against that and saying that the US in particular should withdraw from the Olympics so as not to give the Nazis this kind of platform. And ultimately, what you see is that a lot of the officials on the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, as well as a lot of top American officials, have very little sympathies with the boycott movement and, at the very least, are in some cases sympathetic to the Nazi viewpoint and really want the Nazis to be able to host this Olympics. And so the Berlin Olympics come about kind of through a historical quirk initially, kind of because of this canceled Olympics, almost as like a make do, I think, to Germany. And then they start to take on this magnified importance once the Nazis come to power and really become this center of political tensions and protest, especially in the United States.
You mentioned earlier that the founder of the Olympics had preoccupations about masculinity and an ability to sort of defend the national homeland, that this intersection of sort of militarism and fit male bodies was a kind of key preoccupation. And of course, one can see that in all sorts of countries. The Boy Scouts and Baden-Powell in the UK and in the United States, too. So this was a broad preoccupation, much of it connected to empire. But of course, Germany, Nazi Germany, was an imperially ambitious force of a particular kind. And I wanted to ask you, how did the Nazis view gender and masculinity and militarism?
So, as Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the Olympics, was really focused on prioritizing sort of men and masculinity, he also really saw no place for women at the Olympics. And so, the first Olympics that happens in 1896 had no official women participants. You start to see a few women who are allowed to compete in subsequent Olympics, but it's just a tiny fraction of the number of men who are competing. And so, really, these sports officials, who again, the people governing the Olympics are in this era entirely men and almost all like aristocratic men, they really make no place for women competitors. And so, just in general, when you're looking at kind of any of these countries in the 1920s and 1930s, there's very little room for women to compete. There's a whole thing in 1928 where the IOC, because of outside pressure, introduces the women's 800 meter dash to the Olympics. And then there's like kind of all this like misinformation, false reporting about how these women athletes like couldn't handle running 800 meters and how, they like collapse after the race, which was heavily exaggerated and maybe not even entirely true in the first place. And so then the IOC cancels that event and doesn't have it at future Olympics. And the Nazis are interesting because part of their ideology is centered on this like really rigid structuring of gender hierarchies. And it is a eugenic state. And so they're always talking about, increasing birth numbers for, I mean, specifically for, like white non-Jewish Germans. And so there's this discussion of women as mothers. But at the same time, the Germans actually have a very successful set of women athletes. And that's in part because at a certain moment in the 1930s, you kind of see the propaganda around like women as mothers also align with sports. And so you see kind of all of these newspapers talking about women athletes who are also mothers. That was kind of the way in which it could be validated to the public that, women should be allowed to compete. It was sort of like appealing to their classical femininity and their ability to embody these expectations of womanhood. And so the Nazis, they actually had pretty successful women athletes, even as they are really fixated on sort of increasing this birth rate and ensuring this traditional femininity of the athletes themselves.
Michael Waters is my guest. We're talking about his book, The Other Olympians: Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, at the time that you're describing in the 1930s with the rise of fascism, the rise of the Nazis, as you say, they articulated a complicated politics around the place of women in the world, and including, of course, in sports. At the same time, part of the repressive apparatus of the Nazis was targeted at those people who were labeled asocial. Can you tell us about how the Nazis targeted what we might think of now as the queer community in Germany?
As you mentioned, the Nazis would go after anyone who didn't meet these sort of standards of sexuality and gender. So people, I would think, in like today's parlance, anyone who lived outside of like cisgender heterosexuality, they were seen as a threat to this kind of eugenic state, both I think for this kind of mess of reasons that just ultimately stems from deep prejudice, but it was often the language of reproduction was used against them. So this was especially true for masculine women or women who were lesbians. And there was this kind of, at the time, this tie between the two, which is that women who loved other women, women who presented in too masculine of a way, were seen as sort of unable to contribute to this eugenic state and to this sort of birth-oriented project. And you really see those fears start at this kind of national natalist level, and then you see it trickle down. When we're talking about the Olympics, you see that trickle down into sports too, which is there's this growing fear in Germany and then also across Europe and across America, of women who were seen as being too masculine. And so, actually, a lot of the early women athletes who got attention, they would often have to frame, they would often have to sort of justify themselves by appealing to their femininity and talking about how, their mothers, for instance, And women athletes who, had even something as simple as like large biceps, which is expected from any athlete, would be, a source of different kinds of fear mongering, and this concern that, sports was actually doing something to gender. It was distorting these like re this these binary categories in some way that by doing track and field sports, for instance, women were becoming overly masculine. I think that's also very deeply rooted in racism, because a lot of track and field athletes were, like track and field was the most open to a diversity of athletes, whereas sports like tennis were viewed as being more feminine, I think in part because tennis at the time, you had to be a member of like a private club in order to do it. And so you see this kind of top-down idea of masculine women and lesbian women being some kind of threat to the state, and you kind of see it start to trickle down into how sports is discussed.
Who was Zdeněk Koubek, and what was his early history?
So Zdeněk Koubek, who is this athlete, who's really at the center of my book and my research. He is this Czech track and field athlete who is assigned female at birth, and so for the beginning of his sports career, he plays in women's sports. He is a little bit later to sports. He starts playing when he's kind of in his early to mid-teens. He's also like on the side working at this men's clothing store. He's not very good at it. And once he starts doing track and field, which become his main sets of sports, he starts to rise the ranks throughout the Czech Republic, then called Czechoslovakia. And he becomes, this relatively well-known figure, I think, in European sporting circles. If you lived in the US in the 1930s, you would not have heard of him at the start, but maybe if you were paying attention to that world, you would. And so Kobach is rising the ranks. Eventually, his best sport becomes the 800 meter dash. And kind of like I mentioned earlier, the 800 meter dash in women's sports is taken off the Olympics program. And so to do this sport, the highest level that you could achieve is actually this rival to the Olympics called the Women's World Games, which was started by a French woman named Alice Milliat in the 1920s. And the Women's World Games, this is a slight tangent, is really interesting because whereas I'm talking about how the IOC is focused around male athletes and is governed entirely by men, the Women's World Games prioritizes women. There are a lot of women in leadership positions. And so for Kobach, that is kind of the highest level he can aspire to at the time. Just because the Olympics didn't even have his sport available on the program. And so in 1934, the Women's World Games is held in London, and Kobach wins gold in the 800 meter dash, and he sets a new world record. And that's kind of like the peak of his sporting career. And then what happens after is really the focus of my book, and really what drew me to this in the first place is that he wins gold in 1934. As he writes in this memoir, he kind of has always felt this pull towards masculinity. He's always felt a desire to wear men's clothes, to sort of embrace these different aspects of maleness. And then in 1935, in the fall, he starts seeing a doctor in his home of Czechoslovakia about potentially living as a man and transitioning gender. And then in December 1935, he announces to the world for the first time that going forward, he's going to be living as a man.
And how was Kobach's announcement that he was now living as a man received by the public internationally?
So Kobach, before transitioning, might have been widely known in the sports world, but if you're the average person, especially outside of Czechoslovakia, just would not have heard of him. And so what happens when he decides to transition gender and openly announces that he's living as a man is that he becomes this kind of global sensation. And so, the Czech press is the first people to report on him, but then the story quickly travels across Europe. And then very quickly, by early December, In the US, like all of the major newspapers are writing about him and writing about this star, this track star who is transitioning gender. And, in these headlines, you see plenty of sensationalism and you see journalists like really struggling with like his pronouns, for instance. It's kind of fascinating, but like in the same article, people switch off between almost every conceivable pronoun you could think of. They really don't seem to fully understand how to refer to him. But even through it all, I think what's really struck me as I was reading this is that there's this real curiosity that journalists and the public seem to have about Kobach and about kind of this possibility of transition. And so I should say also that the 1930s is an era in which we don't really have this sense of gender as this, like psychological, socialized concept that's distinct from biological sex, which is something that's kind of assigned at birth based on your body. And so when people are talking about Kobach, they're talking about him through the lens of sex instead of gender, even as Kobach himself is referencing, feeling like a man and wanting to live as a man. And so the coverage of him talks about how he, like, quote unquote, metamorphosized, how suddenly, like, he woke up one morning and then realized that his like body was becoming more associated with maleness, and then going forward he would live as a man. I think that is like a really simple explanation that intentionally kind of elided just the surgical operations that were at play in the background, other things happening. But you see, like, people really want to know how this is possible and how it is possible to move between these categories of male and female as they see Kobach as having just done. And there's this real interest in him and in understanding the categories. And so you have a lot of major newspapers that, task different scientists and sexologists with explaining this to the public. And you have these articles in big newspapers that are saying things about how, it was believed at the time that like every person has bits of like male and female in them. Like we're all kind of born with this like 50-50 split, and then at some point, like one usually overtakes the other, but sometimes it just doesn't really work that way. That was kind of the logic that was used at the time. And I think really to me, reading this coverage, you get this real sense of possibility of gender and sex. It's like this real queer possibility, just in general. This is an era in which the sci like sexology and the science of the body and of sex is really new and cutting edge, and people really feel like Kobach is telling of like what is soon going to be possible and is telling of this future of transition that, in most of the coverage, people don't seem to have many concerns over and are just interested in understanding. And, that's what's really struck me, reading this. I first discovered this story a few years ago, and so, reading this in the context of so much anti-trans policy today and so much transphobia today, to like read these reports in the 1930s that, like might not have used the language that we would use, but expressed not concern about transition, but a real fascination. That really struck me. And then one thing that was really important to me in this book was to try to situate Kobach in a larger queer community, which is a hard thing to do in the 1930s, because there's not like an openly gay newspaper that's publishing, at least in the US at the time. But you see glimmers of what Kobach meant specifically to people who, like might today identify as trans or intersex in some like letters to the editor section of different magazines and newspapers. And there's this one magazine called Sexology that I was particularly interested in. And Sexology is like this, somewhat dubious magazine of science, I'll just say, from the 1930s. But they write this article about Kobach transitioning, as well as this other athlete, this British athlete named Mark Weston. And in response to the article, they get this outpouring of letters from people who want to know how they can do the same thing, people who, might have been assigned one sex at birth, but don't feel like it at all. And they're asking about, how they can have a surgical operation like that too. And they're asking about what the technology allows them to do. And Sexology is so baffled that they write a whole follow-up article in response, just being like, what is going on here? And so The gist of this is that I think the general public is just really curious about Quebec and about transition. And then you see these glimmers of likely queer people who almost see, I think, a lifeline in him and see in his story this potential for themselves that maybe they weren't even aware of prior, this potential to transition or to move between binary categories. In a way that just maybe didn't seem so possible before.
And I want to talk more with you about that closing of that kind of moment where it seemed more was possible and fluid around gender non-conforming people. But I should say I'm speaking with Michael Waters about his book, The Other Olympians: Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Staying with this moment in the 1930s, you mentioned Quebec and you mentioned Mark Weston. There were a number of athletes who received public attention right at this moment, which is, in your counting, a very sort of telling period where people who had been overwhelmingly assigned female at birth then came out publicly as living as men. Can you talk about the other people and whether you would say this was sort of coincidental that a number of people came forth this way or not?
One interesting thing about this era is that while Quebec is kind of the most high profile athlete to transition, you actually have a few other athletes who had careers in women's sports and then begin living as men in the same span of a few years. Mark Weston is this British shot putter who wasn't really as successful as Quebec, but in his hometown of Plymouth, he was a bit of a local celebrity. You know, he had gone to the Women's World Games. He just didn't medal. Another is this bicyclist from Belgium named Willy de Bruin. And I would say that the number of athletes who began transitioning and living as men in this era, I think was probably mostly coincidental. You know, this wasn't just athletes who were transitioning. If you like read even like local newspapers from this era, there are plenty of stories, especially really hyper local stories of people transitioning in different ways. And I think a reason that the 1930s is this really big focal point is that, you know, in the 1920s even you start to see a lot of these technologies of sex reassignment and these different sort of surgical procedures and these early experiments with hormones, they start to get better and better. And it's in the 1930s when there just is more potential to transition, period. So I think that's like the important context for this. I also think it's possible that these athletes just got more attention than they otherwise would have because there were a few of them at once. But I do think you see like a bit, especially in Willy de Bruin's story, you see him talk about how he had always wanted to live as a man. He'd been assigned female at birth. He probably would identify as intersex today based on the way he wrote about himself. But he had always wanted to live as a man. And but it wasn't until he read about Quebec in this Belgian newspaper in early 1936, like right after Quebec transition, that he describes actually deciding to go see a doctor. And so I do think there is a little bit of an element of just, you know, like seeing the possibility in transition, seeing this like really visible figure in Quebec, I think probably made some people feel like they too could do this, made it feel a little bit less scary. So I think that might be part of it. But ultimately, like there were tons of transitionings happening. Just maybe more quietly in the background. And I think the press, especially because of this concern about like gender and masculinity that we are discussing, probably fixated on them a little more so than they otherwise would have.
Well, then turning to the 1936 Berlin Summer Olympics in fascist Germany, infamous Olympics, and one that which you argue in your book is also pivotal in that it helped foreclose this moment of openness around gender identity in the 1930s. Can you tell us what the setting was for the Summer Olympics physically and politically.
In 1936, I think you were seeing a lot of this sort of concern about masculine women in particular in sports. You kind of start to see it reach its high point. So, throughout the early 1900s, a lot of mostly male sports officials were skeptical of women athletes and would often use these sort of telltale signs of, again, like large biceps, deep voices as proof that, sports were like actually doing something to women and were damaging them in some way, and that they weren't fitting these notions of femininity that, officials like wanted to see. And often, even before Kobach and Weston transitioned, you see plenty of anxiety around gender in that regard. And you really start to see after Kobach and Weston's transition in the sports world, that really starts to reach its climax. And so, at the same time as Kobach and Weston are sort of in the news, and I should also say that, Weston had retired from sports and Kobach only wanted to play in men's sports after, and he eventually did. But this idea of transition to sports officials starts to raise alarm. It's a bit of a surprising coincidence because the policies against transition that we have today are so fixated on trans women in sports and intersex women in sports, whereas these were cases of these athletes wanting to live as men. But you start to see this like hyper fixation on women's sports and masculine women in 1936. And at the same time as this happening, there's this American sprinter named Helen Stevens, who at this point in time is like the fastest woman in the world. She is one of America's best hopes for a gold medal at the Berlin Olympics in 1936. And she, because of a childhood accident, has this very deep kind of raspy voice that really becomes a source of fixation about her. There are plenty of commentators even before the Olympics happen that are talking about how she seems too masculine and have all of these different sort of concerns and fear mongering about her. And in 19 and like once the Olympics start to happen, there are all these whispers about her. The Nazis have this press service that talks about how they did a survey and she has the deepest voice of any woman athlete at the Olympics. And then there's this whole news cycle, which is a little convoluted, that I won't go too deep into it, but essentially that it's like essentially there's this claim that goes out after Helen Stevens wins gold at the Olympics in August 1936 that she's actually in some way a man. This Polish newspaper prints this kind of baseless rumor about her. And then you see this follow-up news story in American press about how actually these German officials had already examined her in some way and concluded that she sort of fit their normative understanding of a woman. That report is then rejected by an American Olympic official. So it's actually kind of unclear if Stevens was actually examined in some sort of like seemingly a crude like physical strip test of some kind. But at the very least, this news story really brings into the public sphere for the first time this concern that certain like women athletes would be cheating just kind of by nature of who they are, that there are certain women who are like so suspicious that maybe they shouldn't be playing in women's sports at all. And I really think, it's hard to make a one-to-one comparison, but I think that same kind of anxiety is you see today in different forms around these attempts to ban trans and intersex women from sort of elite sports and all of these different places. And so you really start to see that panic spill over into the press for the first time in 1936 with Helen Stevens. And so as the public is sort of learning about these stories, I should also say that like when the public, when especially when the American public hears these stories about Helen Stevens, like there's like a ton of outrage about it. There are lots of people who are rejecting this, who are saying this is ridiculous, that these are just sore losers. There's not a lot of sympathy to these stories, even as they continue to get printed. And so as this is happening, you see on the back end, this really small group of sports officials who begin pushing forward different kinds of medical examinations for women athletes at the Olympics. And these would eventually culminate in this sort of like set of policies called sex testing that still exists in different forms today. And so you, and this is really sort of pushed forward at the behest of this one Nazi doctor named, this one Nazi sports doctor named Wilhelm Knoll, who is the head of this sort of Federation of Sports Physicians that has a lot of sway and is advising these, the IOC and these other sports federations about policy at the time. And Wilhelm Knoll, you know, he's an ardent believer. He wears his like brown shirt uniform to the classes that he teaches. And he sees these stories about Kobek and Weston transitioning, and he sees them as some kind of problem. I think in a way that's deeply tied to his own eugenics ideologies. And so on the back end, you know, as there are all these stories coming out in the press, sport like high level sports officials begin to set in motion these medical examinations of certain women athletes. And they don't really have a serious conversation about, you know, what this would look like, who would be allowed to compete in women's sports. You know, they don't thoughtfully talk about just the natural spectrum that kind of all of our bodies exist on. At the time, if you talk to a lot of doctors, there were plenty of people who were saying that, you know, there's no one way to cleave people universally into male and female categories. You know, we sex is a spectrum. And that was known and discussed really widely at the time, but sports officials who were crafting these policies didn't consider that, maybe didn't even know that. And instead, they start to institute these really cruel seeming strip tests that are eventually adopted by the International Amateur Athletics Federation, which is the governing body for track and field sports. And those are adopted in August 1936 in Berlin. And this policy that essentially allows any athlete who suspects that one of their competitors has, quote, problems of a physical nature. They don't elaborate on what that means, but the context seems to be like women who are maybe just seem masculine. It's like not even totally clear. But if you lodge this protest, you can actually get a fellow athlete to be physically examined by a doctor, and potentially disqualified. These officials didn't explain like what would be disqualifying, what the exam would consist of. They didn't really engage in any kind of thoughtful way about again, this sort of like spectrum of bodies that we all exist on. But I think like 1936 becomes such a pivotal moment for how we talk about these things because of both this policy and of the story of Helen Stevens, which I think by August they really come together in the form of these sex testing policies that were really just poorly thought out, and honestly pretty punitive from the beginning and really continue to be to this day. And we are still living out the consequences of them to this day. But you can really trace that all back to this really specific Nazi-hosted Olympics in 1936.
Well, in the time that we have left, I wonder if you could just talk about the aftermath of the 1936 Olympics and the advent of sex testing, deeply rooted in Nazi anxieties around gender and purity and eugenics. How should we see that, the shadow of that, into the International Olympic Committee and sports more broadly in the subsequent decades?
You know, so this 1936 policy is only passed by one sports federation, this track and field federation. The IOC itself considers passing a similar policy and ultimately decides to punt the question. So it starts off really small, but I think that first policy comes to influence what is to come. But, you know, by the 50s and 60s, more and more federations begin implementing sex tests. Again, these are all for women's sports only. And by the end of the 1960s, the IOC itself starts to play a really big role in crafting and actually executing these policies. And what you see too is a shift just over and over again, and how these sports officials decide to measure like who gets to be a woman. And so it starts off as these really crude physical examinations, which don't make much sense, don't correspond necessarily to sex at all, and get a lot of pushback. And so later, sports officials by the 1960s switched to chromosome testing instead of doing these strip tests, which also get a ton of pushback from the scientific community. You know, plenty of people have chromosomes that aren't XY or XX. And it doesn't necessarily even mean anything about whether or not you identify as intersex, for instance. And there would be there were athletes who were banned and were made ineligible from women's sports at the Olympics because they had more than two chromosomes, for instance. When that got pushed back, the sports officials then switched to hormone testing, which is still active in some federations today. And really, at every juncture, what you see is sports officials come up against this reality that sex itself is a spectrum, that there's no real way to like universally say who is and is not a woman, who is and is not allowed to compete in this category. And instead of trying to sort of deal with just the messiness of sex and of these categories in a way that might prioritize, you know, the athletes themselves and the humanity of these athletes themselves. Instead, these officials continue to construct new ways of defining who gets to participate that often, and today especially, is excluding trans feminine and intersex women specifically. And, you know, like I'm not an expert on sports policy by any means, but what I see from looking at this history is that there just has never been a real attempt to center the humanity of these athletes themselves and to really deal with the nuances of our bodies, and like just who we are. Instead of having like a more thoughtful conversation about how these categories are imperfect and maybe how you could construct sports policy in a way that sort of deals with that imperfection and centers the humanity of athletes, sports officials have continued to pass new policies that try to find a new way to justify these really rigid categories. And just again and again, I mean, the people who are pushed out, who are villainized, are intersex and trans feminine women specifically.
You mentioned how in the 1930s there was an openness and a fluidity in the minds of the public in seeing gender, and that then closed. But I wanted to ask you how we might think differently about how to organize sports, which at this point remains putting people into rigid binary gender boxes.
I definitely am not an expert on crafting these policies myself. If you look at the research, there are certain sports that maybe don't need to be sex segregated at all. And then there are certain sports that, you know, maybe there is some logic to having at least these different kinds of sex categories themselves. And I think really where I come down on this, having looked at the history, is that, you know, we're only ever talking about this kind of one kind of perceived advantage. You know, there's, you know, like in basketball, there's no attempt to like regulate heights and say that like actually you're too tall to play this sport and because height gives you an advantage. And I think that like we in general and sports officials especially have to sort of reconcile with the ways in which gender and sex are messy and the ways in which, you know, these are all spectrums that we're talking about. And so, you know, sure, maybe there is a case where having specific categories makes more sense for the sport. Like, I think that's completely reasonable to say. What is not reasonable is to create those categories in such a way that you then just exclude a whole group of athletes from them. The fact that there are athletes who, you know, like women athletes today who just have naturally high testosterone levels who then can't compete in the Olympics just because of who they are. You know, we're creating a system in which this private organization is responsible for deciding who you get to be, and who you get to be when you are playing your sport. And I just think that that is not the solution. And I think the way around it is to talk openly and honestly about how these categories are imperfect, and to do so again just by centering the humanity of these athletes themselves. Because when you look at the history, I mean, it's these athletes and their needs and their specific desires just have never been at the center of policy.
Well, lastly, how do you see the ramifications of the kind of gender surveillance that has been institutionalized in international sports as it pertains to the society more broadly?
I do think that when you look at sports in particular, like my theory is, and this is hard to prove, but I think that by creating these sex testing policies at the elite level, like in the Olympics, for instance, I think what that has really done, at least when you look at sports specifically, which I think what that has done is like really normalize this idea of it being possible to definitively say who is a woman and who is a man. Like, I think it's normalized this idea that like we should be able to like test and measure people and cleave people into these categories at the sports level. And I really think like what is happening more recently is you see these policies that started at the elite level trickle down into like school sports, for instance, and you see like tons of anti-trans policies around just like not allowing trans girls and women to play in different kinds of like middle and high school and college sports. And I think like my theory is just that I think normalizing this idea that there is a reason to like ban certain people from sports at the Olympics makes it easier to then say, why don't we do this at this kind of lower tier of sport?
Michael Waters, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with the author of The Other Olympians, Fascism, Queerness, and the Making of Modern Sports. You can find a link to that book at againstthegrain.org. Michael Waters is a journalist and writer. He's the former New York Public Library Martin Duberman Visiting Scholar in LGBTQ studies. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.